Hello there. Today is Tuesday, May 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a U.S. delegation continues preparations for a potential Trump-Kim summit.
We've got to be careful not to be suckered into that with sort of a big offer from Kim Jong-un right at the outset.
America honors its fallen military heroes who've made the ultimate sacrifice.
We mourn alongside their families, and we strive to be worthy of their sacrifice.
Were Americans the target of a sonic weapon attack? Also ahead, an HBO documentary highlights an American hero now battling a fight for his life. It's all on today's International Edition. Glad to have you with us today. There's a new indication that the U.S.-North Korean summit might take place after all. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
In the latest sign, the U.S.-North Korea summit could be on again. The White House says President Donald Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe plan to meet ahead of what the statement terms the expected meeting between Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The White House says Trump spoke with Abe Monday. Since Trump announced last week that the summit was off, there's been a flurry of activity to revive the possible June 12th meeting in Singapore. On Sunday, Trump said a U.S. team was in North Korea to work on plans for the summit.
Well, joining us now to discuss more about what could be happening is Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. Jamil, the meeting was on, then it was off. Now it's possibly heading toward being on again. What do you make of all of this back and forth, and do you think it'll actually take place on June 12th?
I mean, I think what you see happening here is really two very, sort of tough-appearing leaders sort of staring each other down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have Kim Jong-un sending through one of his senior vice foreign ministers the message that that Vice President Pence was a, quote, political dummy, and that if the U.S. could either face North Korea over a negotiating table or over nuclear confrontation, that led President Trump to send that sort of very stiff letter back saying that the summit is canceled. If you want to rehave it, let me know. And now we're proceeding forward like the summit's actually happening. As you said, we have a team over in Singapore led by Joe Hagan. The last time he showed up, nobody else from North Korea showed up, but apparently the guy from North Korea is en route, which is good. The chief of staff, the de facto chief of staff to Kim Jong-un. And apparently there were some conversations that took place in the DMZ also. So it looks like there may actually be a path forward here, but I think what you see here is two leaders staring each other down saying, sort of trying to figure out who's got the more of the lead effort here.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Kim Jong-un captured the diplomatic narrative. Donald Trump now trying to recapture, I think, by saying, I can cancel the summit if I need to. Don't tempt me. And so I think we'll see how this plays out over here in the next few days and weeks.
What I thought was very interesting was when President Trump sent the letter saying that he was not going to hold the meeting, it was sort of a conciliatory tone and then the tough talk combined. I was surprised by how remarkably conciliatory the response was, that we're ready and willing from North Korea.
Look, what you see happening, I think, here is both sides want these talks to happen, but both sides want these talks to happen on their terms and with them having the lead role. And so what you see here going back and forth is sort of what we saw back in the Cold War. You know, who's got the initiative and who's got the strength going in, who's going to come out of this with the upper hand. I think both will attempt to do that as this effort proceeds forward. I think it would not surprise me if, in fact, the meeting does not happen on June 12th. I do think it will happen soon thereafter, if not on June 12th, because I think both sides do want the meeting to happen for different reasons. But I also think both sides want to control the narrative, and both are going to try to. And I think you'll see the same thing happen, by the way, during the negotiations. I think you will see Kim Jong-un come in with a big pitch. He's going to come in with an offer you can't say no to. It's going to be very hard for the Trump administration to say no, I think, to that offer. At the same time, I think that, we have to trust and verify what the North Koreans say they're going to do and know that we're talking about the same things. When you say denuclearization, does that mean you denuclearize or does that mean we both have to denuclearize? Because, of course, if that's what we're talking about, that latter, that's never going to happen.
Do you think it's even possible to be prepared or for the U.S. president to be prepared with the strategy by the 12th of June?
Well, look, I mean, we've had some low-level conversations taking place now or mid-level conversations taking place. We've had some higher-level conversations with Pompeo going over there and meeting with Kim Jong-un. So we've had some preparation. I think that given the negotiating styles of the two people involved here, Kim Jong-un on one side, Donald Trump on the other, I think there's very little that either side can do to honestly prepare for what might be discussed in that conversation. I think the best they can do is agree to basic terms and basic understandings. What does denuclearization mean? What are the time frames we're talking about? What are the basic constructs here? But I think when you put Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump in the room, they're going to hash out something, and the challenge is that both may come out of the room thinking they got a different deal than the other side thinks they got. And that, I think, is what leads to miscalculations, but can also lead to a breakthrough here. At the end of the day, though, no matter what breakthrough comes through and what the North Koreans promise, the thing the Trump administration has to remember is that the North Koreans have been here before. They have promised to denuclearize, they have promised to get rid of their weapons, and they haven't done so, and they've played sort of that game of Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football with the United States before. We've got to be careful not to be suckered into that with sort of a big offer from Kim Jong-un right at the outset.
Is it even realistic to think that they would give up their nuclear weapons completely?
It's hard for me to imagine a scenario in which they would do that. Having seen the cautionary tale of Libya, and particularly having heard the U.S. talk about the Libyan model, I think would be a warning to the North Koreans for their own purposes. Now, that being said, I do think that if the U.S., the president has indicated he's willing to make security agreements and put in place security procedures for the Kim regime, I find that hard to believe that we'd agree to that. I'm not sure the president understands completely what he's signing up for, and so he needs to have those conversations within his team, that he's really willing to make a commitment of American military and economic power to keep North Korea's economy, which is a basket case, and their stability, which is, you know, a challenge because they're not well-loved in the region, and even though their people do love them quite a bit, the North Korean regime, that is, you know, I think most people think that's in part sort of a brainwashing effort that's taking place there. And so I think it's a real challenge to the administration to guarantee both the political and economic security of the Kim regime, although the president has mentioned that in the last few weeks.
All right, Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. We appreciate it. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. The Taliban kills an Afghan man who awarded a Medal of Bravery to President Trump. Maryland town has again been hit by a devastating flood. A new study finds millions could avoid dengue if the world limits warming. And a subtropical storm, Alberto, strikes the U.S. Gulf Coast with a dangerous surf and heavy rains. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Italy's political crisis continues as populist leaders halted their efforts to establish a government after President Sergio Mattarella rejected the choice of a Eurosceptic to become the country's economy minister. Mattarella has turned to former International Monetary Fund economist Carlo Cottarelli to determine whether he can head a caretaker government of technocrats. Jamie Detmer in Rome speaks with International Edition's Sarah Williams about the political turmoil.
Well, we've had more than 80 days of negotiations about having a government since the March elections, which, of course, there was a hung parliament. But the big winners were the populists, the anti-establishment Five Star Movement, and the anti-immigrant League Party. And we've had these negotiations prolonged and going on. It looked like last week we were heading to the first all-populist coalition government in Western Europe since the Second World War, virtually. But it all fell apart this weekend when Mattarella, who has the power to do this, absolutely refused to approve their choice of economy minister, a Eurosceptic who is against Italy remaining within the Eurozone system, in other words, having the euro as its currency. He adamantly refused to approve him. So the populist leaders pulled the plug on the negotiations. The prime minister designate resigned, and now Mattarella has turned to Cottarelli. I mean, this has prompted really what is a constitutional crisis. We have had previous presidents refusing to accept or approve a nomination for a ministerial job about three times in the past, but never as in such a confrontational time as now. So we had the populace now saying that the president should be impeached.
Is there any likelihood of that?
Well, things are very unclear in Italy. Look, we've had more than 60 governments in Italy since the Second World War. Italian politics, famously chaotic, but no one has ever seen anything quite like this before. And it's very unclear how this proceeds. It is possible they could get a vote in Parliament to impeach him. Together, they have a majority in the lower house, but they only have a slim one in the Senate, just about seven seats. Most people think the impeachment won't happen. The bigger question is whether Cottarelli can get a vote of confidence sometime in the next week by the parliament. If he can, then he says he will try to keep this caretaker government going on until early 2019 and then hold new elections. And if he can't get a vote of confidence, he will limp on until September and October, and then we'll have early elections then. The big worry is that we had a very bad-tempered and violent election in March. People fear it could become even uglier and possibly more violent as a result of what happened this past week.
And Cottarelli has a reputation. He's known as a Mr. Scissors, apparently, for some of his promoted spending cuts.
Yes, but on the other hand, yes, I mean, at the IMF, he's kind of famous for that. But in the past, when we've had technocratic governments, we've had quite a few, actually, in Italy the past few years, they've all had to cut public expenditure. Italy is the second most indebted Eurozone country, after Greece, of course. And public expenditure has been too high. It breaches the budgetary rules of the Eurozone as well. So people are not surprised that he will need to start cutting. Equally, on the other side, the populists have wanted an extraordinary expansion of public spending, which was going to put them on course for a conflict with the European Union.
As you said, the Italian politics has been, there have been so many governments since the Second World War. But this sort of recent situation in Italy, what is the reaction from, say, the man or woman on the street to this continuing volatility?
Fear, above all. One of the reasons the populists did well in the last election was a high level of desperation amongst ordinary people about their economic situation, about the future of Italy, about jobs for their kids, etc. So they are very, very concerned about where this is going. And there's also an element of bewilderment as well, in that they seem, well, half of the country voted for change, and we're back having a caretaker government and the old guard of the political establishment back in control. It's going to be interesting to see in the elections how that plays out, whether the populists can capitalize on that and expand their majority, or whether we see possibly an alliance between the old man Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Renzi of the Democrats coming together to form an establishment coalition to try to keep the populace out. We are in very unclear waters at the moment, very dangerous waters for Italy, and it could trigger some kind of Eurozone debt crisis, some kind of contagion as a result of what's going on here.
All right, that's Jamie Detmer in Rome speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. Last week, the U.S. Embassy in Guangzhou, China, issued a health alert stating that a U.S. government employee in that city had experienced strange audio-related sensations. The next day, a physical examination of the employee revealed symptoms that match a mild traumatic brain injury. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the symptoms were very similar and entirely consistent with the health issues that American diplomats in Cuba reported in August of 2017. Those symptoms were blamed on so-called sonic attacks.
We're concerned about it. It's a serious medical incident. We want to make sure and take care of every one of our officers serving overseas. We've learned about it only recently. We are still trying to identify all the circumstances surrounding it.
But was it really an attack, either in China or in Cuba? VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype about that with Timothy Layton, professor of ultrasonics and underwater acoustics at Southampton University in the UK.
I think there's insufficient evidence to link the two. I would also say there is insufficient evidence to link the Cuba incident to a sonic attack. That's not to say it's impossible, but that is to say that it's unlikely, and also to say that the reporting I saw of the Cuban incident was rather selective and tended to be overblow things, to take things out of context and proportion.
So what do you think happened in either or both cases?
I actually get approached by quite a lot of people who say they have been suffering some kind of sonic attack. They have a strange set of symptoms, headache, nausea, tinnitus, a ringing in the ears, migraines, and they think they've been attacked by some other person who's directed sound at them. And I always go through a process of elimination to try and work out with them what is the cause of their problem. And the first thing I do is try and find out if it is due to anything else, because you can have the same set of symptoms caused by stress, anxiety, an infection, poisoning, something like that. And in fact, ultrasound as a weapon is not a great weapon to use. You can't fire it in a rifle over a distance of one city block or something like that, or even 100 100 yards. It doesn't travel well through air. It gets absorbed and it gets bounced off walls. And most importantly, it's an unpredictable device. It's very hard to predict who will be affected by it. If you expose someone to ultrasound and really or high intensity, high frequency sound, the children might hear it and feel unpleasant symptoms, inability to concentrate, headache, something like that. But the people who are most robust against attacks, the people who really you find it hard to affect with high frequency sound, are the adult men, because they've lost their high frequency hearing. They can't hear it. And so embassies have a lot of adult men in them. And so if you're going to attack an embassy, it's a strange weapon of choice, both because it's unpredictable and because the adult men are the most robust against such an attack. Now, looking from one perspective, you can say, here's this very strange set of symptoms, headaches, nausea, tinnitus, and a ringing in the ears, and perhaps people have heard something, and therefore link that to a sonic attack. Looking the other way, you can say, if somebody becomes stressed or anxious, these are the symptoms they get. Doesn't matter what the cause of the stress is. It could be fingers being scratched down a blackboard. It could be worrying about exams tomorrow. It's headaches, nausea, tinnitus, stress. So it can be as kind of a one way of looking at it. And I think this was the way that most of the authorities and the media took, was to say this is a sonic attack because of this strange set of symptoms. The other way is to say, here's a strange set of symptoms you can get from many other sources.
Have you ever come across a real sonic attack? And, you know, if so, how did it manifest itself? How was it done?
I've never come across a real one. So every time that I've ever come across this, it's been an accidental exposure from technology that you can pick up quite cheaply.
Well, if you could come up with something that erases the effects on a lot of people of screaming infants on airplanes, you wouldn't have to work another day in your life.
I know. That's the classic sonic attack.
All right. We just heard from Timothy Layton, professor of ultrasonics and underwater acoustics at Southampton University in the UK, speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you.
I'm the king of the kuntu, and I love the way I do this uncle.
First, a 30-minute playlist of the continent's best music. Then, a live studio interview and music performance by Leni Stern Trio. Think award-winning female electric guitar player falls in love with West African griot music. So lots of love coming to you this weekend. Don't miss it on Music Time in Africa, Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. Yeah!
VOA's International Edition continues now. President Donald Trump paid tribute Monday, Memorial Day, in the United States to generations of the country's fallen warriors in remarks at Arlington National Cemetery outside of Washington.
We are gathered here on the sacred soil of Arlington National Cemetery to honor the lives and deeds of America's greatest heroes, the men and women who laid down their lives for our freedom.
Ahead of his speech, Trump laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Many of the people at the annual commemoration also walked to nearby gravesites to pause and reflect on the sacrifices of their loved ones. Memorial Day, observed on the last Monday in May, has been set aside to honor all who died during military service throughout U.S. history. Once known as Decoration Day, Congress declared Memorial Day a national federal holiday in 1971. And on Monday, Memorial Day in the U.S., when the nation remembers those men and women who made the ultimate sacrifice, HBO premiered a documentary about the life of Senator John McCain, a war hero who lived through brutal torture as a prisoner of war. The film is an exclusive profile of one of the most influential forces in American politics. John McCain, For Whom the Bell Tolls, also features interviews with family, friends, colleagues, and leading political figures. I talked about the film with six-time Emmy Award winner producer Peter Kundhart.
Yes, there was. The diagnosis triggered the film. When we heard that Senator McCain had been diagnosed with brain cancer, our minds shot back to when Teddy Kennedy got the same diagnosis, and we moved into high gear and produced a film for HBO about Teddy Kennedy's life under kind of tight time constraints. So we proposed to HBO that we do a similar thing with Senator McCain, the other lion of the Senate, and we did feel like we wanted to get it out and finished while Senator McCain was alive. It's interesting you raised the issue of kind of an obituary. Our thought was we very much wanted to capture the true John McCain while he was alive and talk to the people who knew him best while he was alive in the present tense, not in the past tense. And the rationale behind that was that I think when someone dies, people tend to kind of get their own little narrative together that sums him up and puts him in the past tense. And we didn't want that. We wanted to talk to people who knew him or were close to him in the present tense and without knowing what the future held, except that he was in bad physical shape. We perceived it as a way to get the most real, honest, true, and emotional reactions from the people who knew him and from the senator himself.
I don't think a living eulogy is necessarily a negative thing either, though. I mean, I think a lot of people would like to hear what people say about them and to sort of look over their life, look back on their life, remember things, talk about it, especially someone who's had so much in his lifetime and has done so much for the country as well. Did you have a goal in mind in making the film as far as besides getting the information out there? Was there a message or something you wanted people to take away from it?
Pretty soon after we had begun, we realized that the message of the film, in addition to trying to color in John McCain's life, was that he does have a message. And the message is, I think this country's system of government is broken. I think it's time that we get together. I think his call for bipartisanship is something that's sorely missing today. And he felt that he had the background and the track record to remind senators that this was something that we needed to get back to. What we found very interesting is the consistency of this message. I mean, it resonates today in this kind of messy, crazy political world we're in. But he was saying the same thing 10 years ago and 10 years before that and 10 years before that. He's been very consistent in the process, due process in legislation and working across the aisle. For a maverick and kind of a feisty, temperamental guy, he's very consistent with how he sees government working, and he thinks it's not working now.
And the film really does a great job of combining his own voice. I think it's fascinating to have unseen home movies and photographs and archived TV footage. And, of course, all of the interviews of all of these very famous, well-known people that know him.
Well, we reached out to all the people who kind of populated, or many of the people who populated his stories. Many of them were his political opponents in various races, and many of them were Democrats as opposed to his fellow Republicans. It was the first film we've worked on where everyone across the board said yes, they wanted to be part of it, and opened up their calendars and got us right in there to talk about it. They all have a soft spot for John, even his most bitter political opponents. He ran for president against George Bush, and he ran against Barack Obama. Both of them adore him and wanted to say that and wanted to talk about him and remember him.
What do you think it is about him that endears him to even people who are his staunch opponents?
You know, that's the key question, and I think it's a very simple answer. He's a really decent human being. We had never met him before, our production team, and we went out to Sedona, Arizona, spent a few days with him, and he has no pretense. He has no veneer. He is what he is. He's a very engaging, fun, straight-shooting, normal kind of guy. He was very generous with his time, and we came away just liking him. And I have a feeling, on some level, that's what his political opponents and fellow senators feel, too. He's the kind of guy you like spending time with.
Obviously, I'm sure he's seen the film now, all put together.
Yes, that is true. My son, Teddy, one of the producer-directors, went to Arizona 2.5 weeks ago, right after he was still in the hospital having had intestinal surgery, and he screened it for him, and McCain watched very quietly And at the end, he put his hand on Teddy's hand, kind of patted his hand, and said, thank you, you nailed it. And he really appreciated it. But he's a man of few words, but he was clearly touched by it and thought we captured the essence of his story.
Does he talk about how he wants to be remembered, or how he stays positive despite all these immense obstacles, and this one, obviously, the fight of his life?
To me, the most interesting thing that he wants people to remember about him are his mistakes in judgment. He holds himself to a high bar, and it's both his family's personal values, the military values that were instilled in him, his own political values that he carried forth. But every time he makes a mistake and doesn't follow his values and something backfires, he wants to remind you that he did that and that he then tried to fess up to his mistakes and do better next time. So he spent a great deal of time being very hard on himself, trying to convey to people that we all make mistakes, follow your inner compass, your moral compass. You won't go wrong, but if you begin ignoring that, you will make mistakes. I found that refreshing.
And that was six-time Emmy winner and producer Peter Kuhnhart on the new documentary John McCain, For Whom the Bell Tolls. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for listening. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, some 815 million people suffer chronically from hunger. And although this is significantly fewer people than the numbers we saw a decade ago, hunger still kills more people than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. On May 28th, we observe World Hunger Day. It is an effort to focus attention on the fact that despite a sufficient availability of food nearly everywhere, globally some 21,000 people die every day from hunger or malnutrition. People do not go hungry because the world does not produce enough food for everyone. According to the World Hunger Education Service, over the past three decades, significant growth in food production, along with improved access to food, helped reduce the percentage of chronically undernourished people in developing countries from 34% to 15%. The principal problem is that many people in the world still do not have resources to purchase or grow enough food. Indeed, hunger is a consequence of poverty and also one of its causes. Hunger exists because many countries lack social safety nets, because in many countries women, although they do most of the farming, do not have as much access as men to training, credit, or land. Conflict, governance systems that do not encourage investment in agriculture, poor management of land and natural resources, lack of educational opportunity, displacement of small farmers by natural disasters, and financial and economic crises that eliminate jobs at the lowest levels all contribute toward creating conditions that push the poorest into hunger. Over the past decade, a global push to reduce hunger and extreme poverty has marked some significant successes, thanks in part to the efforts of numerous international and transnational institutions, foundations, NGOs, and governments, including the United States. But on World Hunger Day, let us not forget that with over 815,000 people still living in daily food insecurity, we still have a long way to go before we can safely say that no child goes to bed hungry most nights, that no parent skimps on their own dinner so that children can eat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.